Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. Today we're going to cover a subject that some of you may not have any clue about, especially if you're brand new to the show. I will say hang in there, because you might find this particular show one of the most endearing, sweet, amazing shows to binge watch on YouTube for free. I found this show through a very interesting set of circumstances, and that someone asked me when I guess I was talking in one of my episodes about the JFK assassination. They said, well, have you ever heard of Dorothy Kilgallen? And of course I hadn't, and I was like, okay. So I look her up online. Someone, I think, gave me a link or something, but I clicked on it and I got some videos about her being a journalist in the mid-60s, and she dies mysteriously, and I've heard all kinds of different stories. There's an official story online, and then there's folks that were alive and near her that I've talked to just randomly recently that have slightly different facts. One of the most important facts was that she was not found in her own home. She was found in a different location. It was later reported that she was found in her own home, having died of a mysterious cocktail of drugs, which is sort of how Marilyn Monroe was accidented, right? But this episode is not about the specifics of that, because I've only delved into it a little bit. This is about a television show at the very beginning of television in the world, 1950. Television had only existed for a very brief time before then. Television in the 40s was very nebulous. There were no networks. There were no shows that had really gained an audience. You know, they hadn't really built the studios to house this kind of stuff. The technology was still evolving to be able to do basic things. People were filming handwritten signs so that they could say the title of their show. We didn't have any special effects or anything. I think it was Bang & Olufsen that came up with the first television in 1939. Little teeny tiny television, smaller than a original Macintosh from the 1984, right? But you fast forward to 1950, and CBS had greenlit this show called What's My Line? And we don't use the word line like we use it today. Line meant line of work. We still say that today, but we always say it together. What kind of line of work are you in? What's your line of work? But we don't say, what's my line or what's your line? But I guess back in the day they did. So the show is very brilliant and simple. There are guests that come on. There's four panelists that have to ask questions, and there's a host. The guest comes on the show and they sign their name. And the host, John Daly, who was the host from the very beginning to the very end. This show ran 17 years. Okay. Amazing. The format changed a little bit when the audience came in. And well, I'll get to the point of why I'm making this episode in just a second. I've hinted at it in previous episodes. But if you're brand new to the show and you see this, in fact, if you love What's My Line and you've never seen the rest of my show, I'm just going to say, be careful watching the rest of the show, all the other episodes. They have nothing to do with this kind of stuff. And you may not agree with my take in this, but I think you will. I sit in a room with folks that are 20 years my senior, and I lament about this, and they agree with me. The point of this show is to demonstrate that the female community of this world was not only respected, but extremely capable, extremely employed, and anything but barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen. Okay? So that's the theme of the show. But to rewind, at the beginning of the format, the show had the guest be introduced as to their name, whether they're Miss or Mrs., just so they get the salutation correct. And then they would march them down in front of the, or have them walk in front of the panelists. And initially the panelists could ask them questions, look at their hands to see if they, you know, had tool marks on their hands, whether they were manicured. Everyone dressed up. That was the cool thing. So the women wore these beautiful dresses, even the panelists. But they'd march them in front of the panelists, come and sit down, and here's the way the show is scored. A basic element of the guest is announced by John Daly, the host, which is usually self-employed or salaried, which means they work for someone else. And then the questions randomly begin with one of the panelists. The panelists are very important. This is where Dorothy Calgallon was on the show almost every single episode until we think she was murdered some 15 years later. Now, the four panelists made of usually, it eventually boiled down to two women and two men. The very first couple episodes had three men and one woman, Dorothy Calgallon. But they're able to ask the guest any number of questions until the guest gets to say no 10 times. And for every single time they say no, they get $5. Now, in 1950, it's about $600. When you win $50, it's about $600 in our day and age. But again, these are mortal people producing a show, paying for the studio time, paying everyone's salary. Some of these salaries were really high, okay? One of the guests by 1953 was getting paid $1,000 an episode, while Dorothy was getting $500 an episode. Still amazing amounts of money for appearing every Sunday night. I don't know the exact broadcast time. Now, the reality is I'm going to just glance through the format of the show real quickly so that when you see it, you really understand what you're looking at. What the show evolved to very quickly within the first year was that the first two guests were just normal human beings from our walk of life. But the third guest was what they called a mystery guest. And all the panelists have to put on blindfolds because someone would walk out who's extremely famous. The crowd would go crazy. They sign their name. They sit down. And then the panelists get, eventually, they only get one question, no matter if they're right or wrong, and it moves to the next person until, again, either they answer 10 wrong or ask 10 questions that equal a no answer, or they find out who it is. Now, most of the time with the famous guests, they usually can figure out who they are. And there's reasons for that, which I'll get to. But you have the most famous people on planet Earth on this show. Walt Disney, Sammy Davis Jr. You have every female actress that's been anyone from Betty White. She looks so absolutely gorgeous. You have a young Barbara Streisand, Julie Garland. And sometimes those famous people guest as panelists at a later time. So Sammy Davis Jr. was a panelist several times. You had Ronald Reagan as a panelist at one point in time. And he's also a guest. Now, the guests, when they're famous, they typically change their voice, which makes it super duper funny to see people talking voices that they don't have. And some of them are utterly brilliant. And then if there's time, there's a fourth guest that usually has a fairly abbreviated time span, and what'll end up taking place is that they'll run out of time. And so John Daly, the host, who was one of the most famous news broadcasters in history, when Pearl Harbor was hit, John Daly was one of the, I think he worked for CBS, but he's one of the first journalists to announce the attack on Pearl Harbor back in 1941, December 7th. So he is moonlighting as the host of What's My Line, but he's doing all kinds of other stuff in the news broadcasting world during the week. So the show evolves and simplifies, and they get rid of what they call walk of shame. The first year or so, the panelists were sitting down as soon as the show started. And eventually, the audience said, well, we want to know what the women are wearing. They're wearing these beautiful dresses. We'd like to see them walk out in these beautiful dresses. And so eventually, the show matures and the women start walking out. The men are always in tuxedos. But now, let's rewind to the theme of this show. I just bumped into this out of thin air, and I almost think it's sort of, I bumped into it as a destiny for my own brain and my own gut feeling that the world wasn't this way, that women were not repressed, that women, I mean, there was a point when women couldn't vote, and that was well handled by 1950, and definitely completely solved by this strange thing that broke apart the United States of America by the mid to late 70s, the feminist movement, which we now know through Aaron Rouzeau, who's friends with Nick Rockefeller, that that was a big scam to get women into the workforce such that they would be taxed. Now, that's nothing new. Women in the workforce was nothing new. So even some of that is sort of a spinoff from the truth. But you had the, a woman had the choice to stay home and raise her children and be a housewife. I have one grandmother who was a housewife and raised five children. I have another grandmother who raised two children, and she worked from the age of 17 to the age of retirement, I guess in her 60s, as a fifth grade school teacher. So I start watching this show at home, and I'm binge watching this thing. And I will tell you this, the mystery guests are pretty interesting. Like Liberace went on there several times. And people that, you know, depending on your age, you'll know who these people are. You won't know who these people are. But a lot of times when you don't know, looking them up on Wikipedia is fascinating. Looking them up on YouTube. But you have Bing Crosby and Fred Astaire. And you have, I think, Frank Sinatra. You have Frank Sinatra's daughter later in the 60s. These Boots Are Made for Walking. That's his daughter who sings that song. You have Lucy and Desi. You have Lucy by herself, Desi by himself. Everyone who was anyone between 1950 and 1957 came on this show. Now, they have other guests that they have to wear blindfolds to because they'll be identified by their appearance because they're well-known politicians, or they even have like the Buckingham Palace guards come in with their full Russian, or no, Canadian bear hats, you know. And so the audience sees it, but the panelists can't see it. Now, before we get into the theme of this, I want to explain the panelists that eventually ended up being the common panelists on the show. Now, Dorothy Kilgallen is a very interesting woman because her father was a journalist in New York. I can't remember exactly what paper, but it's like the New York Times or something back when it was normal. But she had gone off to school to get educated and eventually dropped out of college and took her career into her own hands, which at the time was a very common thing. But all by herself, she developed a Broadway column that had over 6,800 syndications across the United States by 1960. It was called The Voice of Broadway. And so she would just monitor everything that's on Broadway and report on it. Who's who? What's what? Just a nice, friendly tabloid without getting into probably, you know, she got into a few risque things, but it would just be that it wasn't so damning and hurtful like it is today, you know. Society had some rules back in those days, right? And the way the show gets introduced is that the first panelist, Dorothy, usually is always the number one position. It changed a couple times, but eventually settled down that she was always the first one in the room. But they have to introduce the person to their left until they get all the way around to the last panelist on the fourth one, introducing John Daly. So Dorothy comes out first. The second panelist vacillated between a person that would be coming every single Sunday to a random guest, a really famous actor or singer or performer, and then it would be a woman named Arlene Francis, who I didn't grow up with her in any of my walks of life. She did a lot of on-Broadway work. She did some music. She's an Armenian woman who's utterly gorgeous. She was married to a fairly famous man named Martin Gable. And he would guest as well. See, this husband-wife trio or duo every once in a while, which is kind of interesting. Very brilliant man. But to Arlene's left, it changed between a guy named Bennett Cerf, who helped found Random House Publishing, which is where you get your dictionaries from, to a gentleman who was a comedian named Hal Block, H-A-L, or Hal Block, excuse me. And Hal had made a career out of sort of being one of these sort of edgier comedians. And he was on from 1950 to 1953. And he's going to be part of our story. Because we're talking about the power of women in this episode. But let's take a break from setting up the show, and let's just talk about some of the people that are on the show. So I was raised in the 70s, right? I watched personally housewives go into the workforce earlier and earlier and earlier. Housewives being convinced that, again, raising a family was stupid, and working for some giant corporation that doesn't care whether or not you live or die, well, that's the end-all, beat-all peak of life, right? But I thought, the way I was raised with this feminist movement around me, okay, and the movies like 9 to 5, right, that women were weak, even though, now this is funny, even though women in my life weren't weak, the women in my hometown weren't weak, I bought what was coming through the television. I bought what was coming to me from the silver screen. Women were these weak things that ran in the forest if a monster is chasing them, and they always fall and get themselves killed or get their guy killed, right? They were just barely intellectually capable of holding a job. You know, yeah, women can work, but, you know, they're sort of the women that bring you coffee, and they're the ones that the bank tellers, they're never the bank presidents, you know, always a weak job for that poor, sad brain that's between women's heads, right? That's what I was taught, either directly on point or through metaphorical themes in shows and movies that I watched. What is a female versus a male, real quickly? They're made of all the same stuff we're made out of, guys. And on the flip side, we're always taught as kids that women or little girls actually mature faster than boys. And having had a little girl, I can tell you that's true. So we're getting this doublespeak, but we're believing the one that is slanderous, at least in my generation. Women give birth to men. Men and women are almost identical physiologically, except for our differences in birthing, right? They're built to be a little bit more sensitive on the right brain side, so that when the children have to have someone empathetically feel their needs, a mother through millions of years of whatever, or God's design, or both, needs to be, in touch with that. That doesn't mean stupid. That doesn't mean weak. Jesus, take care of like 5 kids and tell me that's a job for a weak, meek person. Give me a break, right? The men, well, we're supposed to be left brain, very myopic about killing animals and cooking them so the family has some food. I know some cultures are the opposite, whatever. Very few in the world are that way, but there is examples of that, right? At least we're told. Men are supposed to be out there working. We have to do all the crazy stuff, work in coal mines and do this other stuff, right? I could go on for an hour just in the indoctrination that I had to swallow as a kid about women being weak. And it echoed in the men around me too, right? As soon as there was a difference between men's opinions and women's opinions, you know, there was definitely a group of guys that would always go at the jugular of how stupid they were. It was never a majority of men. I'd hear it every once in a while. And then I started watching What's My Line? And this was one of the coolest experiences because I'm watching this at my house, and then I start watching it at my smoke lounge, and I have a gentleman who's in his late 60s who comes, and he and I are usually the last two guys out of the place. And at one point, we had the remote control, and I said, look, have you ever seen What's My Line? He's like, no. I said, check this out. Boom. Played it. He's addicted instantaneously. He is from that generation as a young man, so he knows a lot of these folks, like Roy Rogers. You have John Wayne. I mean, it's just crazy. But you have a ton of females as well. They do an amazing job in this show of balancing female guests versus male guests. And usually, it's one woman, one man, or one man, and one woman. Usually, let the woman go first. And then the mystery guest is back and forth between male and female. Just go look at the thumbnails on YouTube. And again, I'm going to restate this so that if you guys are watching the show or you're looking at the thumbnails and you're not sure if you want to watch it, you're going to learn that it's the normal people that bring out the most humor and the most hilarious questions. Because I'll give you an example. Recently, there was a show. It's There's a guy named Johnny Ray. Look for one of his earlier appearances. I didn't know who this guy was. He's a musician. He's a singer. But his show has a guest that is a captain of a garbage, whatever they call those, I forgot the name, but the garbage boats, you know. And so his product is garbage. And so the guests were trying to figure out what he did by trying to figure out what his product was. And for the first half of the questions, they're talking about wearing garbage. When would I wear this on my body? Could I hold this? Would a woman wear this on her body? You know, and it just got really hilarious that they're talking about garbage, thinking it was some sort of apparel. So you get these funny little, you know, situations where things happen like that. But I keep watching this, I keep watching this, and I keep seeing all these females come on. And their jobs are amazing. I mean, they don't really put normal jobs on there, but they do. I mean, they have those on there, but the majority of the jobs are sort of more interesting, thus more difficult to guess within whatever number of questions, 20 to 30 questions. And the interesting thing was that you have the audience celebrating their jobs, because the way the show works is that when the guest sits down, John Daly makes sure that they understand how the show is scored. They did that for 17 years. I can't believe they continue doing that. I don't think Jeopardy verifies the rules every single time, right? But they'll say, we're going to let the audience and the guests at home and the audience at home see just what your line is. And on our television set, they overlay the name of the job. And so we get to see it, but the panelists obviously don't. And so we know the whole time how ludicrous these questions are, how close they are to guessing what they do. They also used to have, for about the first 5 to 8 years, a free guess where the panelists got to just look at them and go, well, I think you do this, and I think you do that. And sometimes they got it right in the free guess. It's such a bummer for the guests because they don't get to play a show. They eventually got rid of that because it took time up, and it was kind of a bummer if they ever got it right. It just wasn't a positive thing. But there's so many elements to the show I want to highlight to you, so if you watch it, you're really cognizant of what's going on here. The women do amazing things on this show. And even though they're being celebrated, and as soon as their career is flashed up, that the audience will a lot of times clap and get really happy that this woman has a great job. And so it reinforces every single Sunday night for 17 years, 52 shows a year. I don't think they took a break. It must be unbelievable. I haven't seen the same episode twice, except when I watch one at home, and I want my buddy at the shop to see it too. But these women are everything on the planet, from wrestlers to scientists to politicians, from mayors to senators. There's a woman who ends up coming in who runs the Israeli female army. I think it's even an Air Force division. You have also in the spectrum of women that are on the show, they're not all young, you know, whippersnappers. You've got women of all ages from 17 years old all the way up into their 80s. Women who use their hands. Women who also, this is also an interesting thing, if you pay attention, when John Daly says if they're salaried or self-employed, there's a giant, probably less than 50%, but I'd say at least 35 to 40% of the women are self-employed. And they're not self-employed in some goofy way. They're self-employed by having created real companies. Women who create food products that are famous in the United States of America. Like I said in a previous episode, there's a woman who makes horse saddles. Very expensive horse saddles, right? $6,500 horse saddles with like inlaid silver and stuff. You never see any of this stuff on the show, but they talk about it. And John Daly will make a point to really accentuate the amazing nature of some of these jobs. And there's no belittling. It's not like, it's really amazing that you're a weak female, but you have this great job. Nope. John keeps it first class the entire time. He's in his tuxedo. And John will say, well, you know, I think it's just amazing what you do. I think what you do is, you know, phenomenally talented, and it's just fantastic. You created a great company. But he's doing the same thing for the guys as well. He does tend to give a little bit more compliment to the females, but he doesn't do it again in one of these, wow, it's amazing. You're actually a female and you have a company. It's completely opposite tense, so that the little girls watching in that time frame hopefully feel like $1 million, right? There was an older woman I just saw recently. And again, I've probably only seen, I'm guessing, because I have no idea, I've probably only seen 25 to 30% of the episodes, and I've been watching this for a couple months straight now. I don't watch it one every single day, and I'm trying to slow down my consumption at home so I don't outrun my buddy at the shop. But there was a woman in probably her 50s who was a rocket engineer for Lockheed Martin, like I said in a previous episode. So think about the level of education and acceptance and accomplishment it takes to get that job. She couldn't talk about the rockets. That was funny because one of the guests or one of the panelists who likes to ask some follow-up questions once they figure out what their line is, he asked, you know, can I ask you how big this, maybe it was even Arlene Francis, they were saying, well, how big are rockets? And a couple other questions. And she just said, I can't tell you. Classified. Okay. Right? Now, we've seen these movies that have come out recently where there's a group of females that worked on the Apollo missions, right? And regardless of those didn't go to the moon or did go to the moon, doesn't matter. Those calculations were created by these women. I think I said way back in season one, if you want to look up the history of the word bug being associated with bad software, it was a female technician of one of the first artillery computers they had for World War II who found a moth inside of a relay. He had flown inside the relay, a big old fat switch, and as the relay tried to collapse and complete the circuit off and on, it was hitting a moth body, and she found it, she pulled it out, and she taped it to a piece of paper, cleaned the switch, and the computer started working, and she wrote, "We got a bug in our computer." And that's where that term was invented. Madame Curie, one of the premier researchers of uranium and radiation, was a female, right? You guys know these stories, right? But for some reason, we buy the propaganda that we need these huge feminist movements to somehow protect what was already there to begin with, right? Now, there's an interesting thing about this show that has to be disclosed. Things were a little bit different in the 50s. Things smoothed out a little bit in the 60s. But this Hal Block guy was a very interesting cultural test for the show. He was only on it for 3 years, and then he left the show. He left the show because he had a personality that wasn't quite jiving with the other panelists and the way they wanted the show to feel. Now, again, he was a comedian, so he was used to getting away with saying things probably in nightclubs that you don't see on national television. But one of his shticks on the show, because he was a single man, was anytime a really beautiful woman came on the show, there was always catcalls and whistles, which, again, wasn't frowned upon back in the day. A woman takes care of herself and looks beautiful and wears a beautiful dress, there's a couple whistles in the audience. And it wasn't like, oh my God, how dare you acknowledge all my hard work to look beautiful. It was, you know, you see these little smiles and grins on the women's faces like, wow, I did it. I impressed this audience. Again, some women don't like that. Some women do. It's your choice, right? It doesn't really happen anymore anyway, right? But Hal had this overtone, and he would make a lot of jokes about dating the guests, if they were beautiful females. And it at times was sort of palatable. You could kind of go, oh, okay. Yeah, that's a funny little joke. And it was usually at his expense, right? He was always making the joke, usually that he didn't have a woman and because of his own whatever frailties or whatever idiosyncrasies and, you know, would you please date me or something like that. But towards the end, towards 53, this got a little out of hand, and it almost got out of hand to a point you're thinking, I think he's really trying to get these girls' phone number. At different times in the show, the guests will either exit behind John Daly and walk off to the side, or they walk through in front of the guests, the panelists, excuse me, and shake hands with each one of them. And sometimes this Hal Block guy would kiss their hands or get a little too frisky in that little ritual. Nothing insane, okay, but definitely not something that probably should have taken place. Now, again, when the panel settled down, the panel was Dorothy Kilgallen, this Bennett Cerf, the Random Publishing House guy, Arlene Francis, and this Hal Block guy. Well, the first three panelists are married very successfully, families. And so when they see the single guy at the end, you know, it's kind of a joke to them that he's still single, but eventually he started rubbing them wrong. I don't want to pick on Mr. Block too much. He, I believe, had a DUI or something while traveling to Florida, and he ended up saying some foolish things while he was drunk to the police, saying that he was a big man and that, you know, they can't keep him behind bars, and he just had a little moment, okay? And this reached New York, of course, because he's a famous guy. He's this, you know, Sunday night panelist on What's My Line, which is starting to blow up and get really popular. And eventually there was a conversation among the other panelists and the owners of the show and John Daly that maybe Mr. Block isn't right for the show. And in one night, they let him go. Bennett Cerf took the first seat towards John Daly, and they decided to take the third seat, which is the second one that's introduced, and pull in a guy named Fred Allen. And I didn't know anything about Fred Allen. Fred Allen is a legendary comedian, of which, you know, to put this in perspective, Fred Allen was famous back in the sort of Charlie Chaplin days as a comedian. He was in show business just as fast as you could get in it. But the Marx Brothers said that they actually stole material from Fred Allen. If you know about the Marx Brothers, that's an amazing statement, right? Groucho Marx was also a panelist several times. He was a guest several times. And he actually was one of the few people to substitute for John Daly on the, like, four or five times out of 17 years that John Daly wasn't there to host the show. But think about it for a split second here. The reason why Hal Block was not invited back to the show, the catalytic event was his DUI. I think if I remember that right. But the reason why he was pulled off the show is because his sexist remarks in 1953. This is at a time when, again, a woman would walk on stage, and if she was really pretty and young, or even just pretty, they'd whistle every once in a while. They would, as panelists, inquire as to whether or not the beauty of a woman actually played a role in her business, whether or not she was a model or perhaps someone who presented or sold things using her beauty, right? They did this to the men as well. Really handsome man comes on. The ladies, Arlene Francis, even though she was married, she was notorious for asking and making little comments about how, you know, handsome men were. She's loyally married, right? Now, the tragedy, Paul Harvey to Hal Block's story, is that the poor guy died penniless in a motel on fire. Somehow there was a fire in his apartment. We don't know if he tried to commit suicide or it's just some horrible mishap, but the poor guy died a tragic death. So obviously he was very talented to get on the show. Poor guy. But once he left, the show locked in. Fred Allen was the primary guest panelist until he had a massive heart attack walking his dog in New York City, I believe in 1958. And he had traded places with a guy named Steve Allen. And there was a lot of jokes that they were related, but they're not related. And so Steve would kind of substitute for Fred when he was doing. Fred had his own show. In fact, Fred had a couple different shows. But it was a very, when Fred died, suddenly, there's a show. And you can find these by typing in What's My Line, and it'd be like, you know, Fred Allen's death or something like that. And you'll see the show where they had to somberly announce his death. And Steve Allen had this touching moment. It's a bit off the theme, but it's part of the character of the show, where Steve said, you know, I was always asked whether or not Fred Allen was my father. And he paused for a second. He said, I couldn't think of a better honor if that had been the case, because it's going to take me everything in my power to fill his shoes. And Steve Allen had his own show. Steve Allen was the precursor to the Johnny Carson show. That show, he had the late night show that eventually had another guest host and then Johnny Carson. But if you've ever heard the phrase, is it bigger than a bread box? That is Steve Allen coining that question on What's My Line. It's very interesting. I heard that when I was a kid. Well, is it big as a bread box or bigger than a bread box or would it fit in a bread box? All those questions come from Steve Allen. Now, that may have been an old saying a long time ago, but think about it. This is a 20 questions kind of question to ask. So for now, I'm going to give the full credit to Steve Allen. So one of the dimensions of giving credit to women back in those days were the incredible guests that came on and their jobs and their ability to articulate the answers to the questions, right? These people do get really, really nervous because television was brand new, people. So you'll have a couple, you know, guests that'll be a little, they'll ask them a really straight question like, are you human? And they'll pause for a second. You're like, what are they pausing for? And they're just nervous as hell. But two of the most profound women to ever be on the show are the two female panelists, Dorothy Kilgallen and Arlene Francis. Well, Dorothy's a writer, so she's very articulate. When the mystery guests come on and they're famous, well, Dorothy has the drop on them because she's got a column. If anyone's even in New York, if Frank Sinatra were to land in New York to go to a show, she immediately has him as a potential guest on the show. And just to kind of give you the full DNA of how this is done, technically speaking, the mystery guests were never announced, of course. The staff internally was kept to like a bare minimum number of people. Maybe two or three people backstage knew who was coming that night. And sometimes they were brilliantly orchestrated, and I'll get to those in just a second. But they would be in a black limo, covered up head to toe, pushed in the back door, taken up an elevator, and pushed into the studio under complete secrecy. So if they ever got the guest correct, it was a big deal. It was real. Some of the tricks they pulled, now again, I haven't seen all the episodes, but one of the tricks I saw was brilliant, was that one of the producers of the show had taken a trip to London, and he was over there because they had the show rebranded in all the major countries in the world. So they had one in Canada, they had one in Scotland, one in Paris, you know, I mean, it was all over the place. So he would go and visit and kick off the shows and make sure, you know, just be a present to the franchising of the show. Some of the guests that were mystery guests were actually other panelists from the shows in different countries. It was kind of funny. But they took this producer. He was supposed to go on a 2-week trip. And he came back a week early. But of course, they didn't tell the panelists that this guy came back a week early. So they hid him from any of the communication. He ever came to the studio. And so that night that he came back, he was a mystery guest. And of course, in their brain, they think he's in London. So there's no way they're going to guess him, but they actually ended up figuring it out, which is pretty funny. When you see the systematic breakdown of a guest by these panelists, and again, I shouldn't have to say this. This is sort of a silly thing to say, oh my God, these women were so smart. That's sort of a backhanded insult to the notion that, of course, they're fucking smart. They're made of the same DNA that men are made out of, right? Minus just some needs for birthing, right? You know, back in the day, you know, it was pretty much a one-way street for how we were attracted to each other, right? But they had gay guests, too. I'll get to that in a second. And there was no weird stuff, okay? But to watch Dorothy break these people down, because Dorothy has a just in all my calculations of the shows that I've seen, Dorothy and Arlene have a incredible success rate of guessing these professions and breaking them down and listening and taking notes between everyone else's questions. Super analytical minds and very three-dimensional people. They're not robots. They have personalities. And, you know, Dorothy's very kind of conservative and sweet and kind of coy, whereas Arlene is like super duper famous and she's more, you know, voluptuous and with her personality, and she's just more like she'll quip a lot more. But when Dorothy says a joke, it can be more special at some points because she doesn't joke as much, right? It's just one of those kind of dynamics, right? Bennett Cerf is this cute guy who he sort of has that kind of New England. I have a friend of mine. I think Bennett was Jewish, and I have a friend of mine who's Jewish who has this same sort of speech pattern, this sort of, I don't want to say it's a speech impediment, but it has this speech sort of mix between a Kennedy and this special accent, right? It's just funny how you see those things repeat. But you see utter and complete brilliance from start to finish on this show, right? So you think, you know, again, one of the things was that there was a lot of controversy around being gay, and there was at times, okay? This Johnny Ray guy that showed up on that one episode, very handsome guy. He has a little hearing impairment in his left ear. Poor guy, I guess, in Boy Scouts was doing some ritual, and it resulted in him being nearly deaf in his left ear, and then he had a procedure done in 1958. The 56 episode is the one that I'm talking about. He was on there again later on, but he had a procedure performed in 58 where it nearly made him deaf in both ears, unfortunately. But he was one of the guests, and in real life, he was married at the time, and then it sort of started coming out that he, you know, had a partner who was a guy. And the show didn't care. That's the cool thing. The press tried to have a heyday with it in the outside world, but the show was like, Johnny, get your ass back on this show, right? We love you. Don't even worry about it. And that's what's cool about this show, right? In the middle of all that controversy, he was welcome back. No problem. Now, I don't know if anyone knew Liberace was gay, but he's been on that show 4 or 5 times. I mean, the guy's you know, so legendary that the applause for him is so evident that the panelists almost know it's Liberace because he walks in the room. He's that famous at the time, right? But there was an episode, and I can't remember what year it was, but a transvestite came on the show. A man dressed in a dress. And here's what's interesting about it, because when you watch the show, if you're like me, the way they frame the first shot where they sign their name on a blackboard. Now, the first couple shows, if you try to go back to the beginning, they were signing a black marker on white paper, and they realized because of the way the cameras worked, the white would overwhelm the camera sensor and it was hard to read. So they switched it very quickly to a blackboard, which introduced this whole logistical thing. They had to figure out a way to swap this blackboard real fast, and it was brilliant how they did it. You'll see them do it every once in a while. But what happens is a hand comes in the camera to start signing a name. And one of the things you'll notice is some of the beautiful penmanship. Oh my God, some of these people have the most gorgeous signatures on planet Earth. And just being sort of a person who loves calligraphy and fontography, it's beautiful to watch the cursive. Some guys, you know, they're more like, you know, the blue collar guys that print their names and it takes them forever. Some guys who are really old scribble this cursive and you can't possibly read it, but John Daly walks up and says their name perfectly. It's really funny, right? But here comes his hand in the shot, and I immediately call it out, and I'm like, oh, that's a guy. Big, strong hand, but it's a woman in a dress. And I'm like, oh, okay, so it's the woman with man hands, okay. But then the guy sits down, and he's got this horrendous Adam's apple, right? And I forgot what he did as a career, but it's a normal session, completely normal session. And it became, and he said he was married. He was from Hollywood. Uh-huh, right? But he's on the show, and I'm watching him, and I finally was like, I think that's a dude. This is amazing. A guy came on a national television show in a dress, which they could have stopped him, right? He was backstage before he came in. He has to send his picture, he has to send his career to get invited to the show. So it's not like you randomly walk into this show. But there he is, a transvestite. I went into the comments section on YouTube and people were like, I think that's a dude. Yeah, I think it is. Isn't it cool how they didn't treat him weird? They treated him just like a normal person. Oh my God, what an idea, right? So the show has all these dimensions. Now, some of the careers of the females that I saw on this show that were really interesting is you have one old lady was a, and I say old because she was old and she said she was a bank guard for a little tiny bank in the Midwest. And at first you're thinking, oh, these are ceremonial roles. And eventually John Daly looks over at her because he was in the military and he's from South Africa, but he's looks like he's from America, whatever. He, I guess at one point had been some honorary deputy and he goes, looks over to her at, after they guess what she is. I think they find out what she is. And he says, well, you know, how many people do you haul in a year? And she's like, oh, something like 50, you know? So she's a real guard. And, you know, she's talking about mainly people loitering or, you know, causing a small ruckus. It's not like a big gunfight or, you know, someone robbing the bank. But you get the sense that this woman would perform just like any other dude, right? Eventually, I saw one with another woman, probably in her late 40s, early 50s, and she comes on and she's a bouncer at a bar. There you go, man. Full spectrum. From scientist to bouncer to women who have clothing lines to women who own their own chain of food items, right? They had the guy that invented the hula hoop who got guest in about two questions. And then his partner came on the next week and they couldn't get him at all. Hilarious. So what do we do with this information? If you watch this show and you start looking at your own past and you start asking what grandma did, and, you know, because you have two families on both sides, and if you're privileged enough to know both sides of the family or somebody knows the history, then you can say, well, what did grandma do over there? Doesn't matter if you're even related to them or not. You know, you'll find strong females absolutely everywhere. Forever, right? Yeah, we've had some bad eras. Yes, we've had moments when they couldn't vote. Okay. And that's really because we undid society from being more balanced to being imbalanced, and then we rebalanced it, you know. Coming from the Midwest, and again, looking at all these females that were the mothers of 10 to 20 kids, you know, they were a lot more brutal in the 1800s with kids. You know, it's like you get your ass out there and you work, and I don't hear any crap about what your wants are versus our needs as a family, right? And I don't want to spin this positive episode into something really negative at the end. So let me be as sort of symbolic and metaphorical as I possibly can to keep this on a positive uptick. Okay. Hopefully this is positive for you. But we really have women divided right now in what they want in life. The men, we still do what we want. I mean, I shouldn't say it that way. Men do what they have to do. And then they do sort of what they want at the same time. Same old, same old. We're not allowed to be, Mad Men. Again, a show that showed men being absolutely sexist, slapping chicks on the ass, and everything's TNA this and TNA that, and you have the right to behave like that. That's a fictional show on television. All right. I think I told you guys a story a long time ago. I don't remember what season. It wasn't three, I don't think. My grandmother was studying to be a teacher, and the way it used to work was that you would go to a town, and one of the homes in the town had to house you, and they would apply with the town to do it. I think they got a subsidy for doing it. So my grandmother lived in this house with this family, and there was a cultural difference because the family wasn't from America, and I'll just let you guess where they're from, but there was a macho-ness, a part of the culture. So part of that's responsible for the way this gentleman behaved. But my grandmother was a drop-dead brunette, gorgeous woman, okay? She was. And the way that the house worked was that, you know, the men did their thing, the women did their thing. And back in the day, it was, and even went up to the point I was a kid, the women cooked the food and cleaned it up afterwards. And men did all the other dirty work, right? So it was a nice trade-off there. But they had just finished dinner, and there was the cleanup phase. And the men are all sitting out front, and this guy is the husband of the wife of this house. And he has some male friends over. And I guess his male friends were sort of jibing him about, you know, that girl that's living with you is really pretty. I bet you love to be with her. I bet you can't be with her. And he had a little bit to drink. And this would have been 1929, as a matter of fact. My grandmother was 17 years old, already moved out of the house, already working for herself, right? Teaching kids. And so she's cleaning up the dishes. The wife is in there as well. And this guy comes in the kitchen and basically grabs my grandmother's butt and kind of pushes up on her, right? Now, she's a Erie, Kansas girl and was never raised like that because they didn't raise girls like that to take that kind of stuff, right? So my grandmother spun around and famously punched him so hard in the nose, she broke it. Just troughs of blood come out of this guy's face. And, of course, he's very angry about it. His buddies are laughing at him. And my grandmother told me that his wife said, "Thank you, because that was incredibly disrespectful to me." And she moved out of the house fairly quickly, of course. But there you go. 1929. My grandmother broke this guy's nose. I have seen something on the playground, as well as something in real life, but it really happened on the playground, when kids are very impressionable. And it was this game where someone would convince someone that they need something that they don't have. You see it all the time today, right? You need the PlayStation. You need the cell phone. You need the latest cell phone. You need that fancy car. You can't have a beater car. You got to get the top of the line convertible, whatever, right? There's reality shows based on this dilemma. And we see it in a material fashion and we kind of blow it off. Well, that's just that spoiled, rotten kid or bad parents or all the above, right? But I think we need to understand that it happens at a victimization level on a sociological level as well. Someone walks up to a group of people, a classification of people, a group of men, a group of females, young females, older females. And they know that there's some disenfranchised feelings going on. I got an episode about it. And they lean in with an ulterior motive to manipulate these people as much as they possibly can. And they whisper in their ear, just like the serpent whispers into the metaphorical Eve. "Bet you'd like to eat that apple, right? That guy up there said you can't eat this. I mean, who is he to say you can't do what you want to do?" And Eve's like, "I don't really care about this apple. I got everything else I need." "No, but you don't know that this is the sweetest fruit in this entire garden. He's keeping it from you because he's not willing to share." Right? It's not a true story, of course. Some of you might believe it is. I don't believe it is. But it's a great metaphor for how we get manipulated in this world today. A group of people come up to you and say, "What are you doing?" And the woman goes, "What do you mean, what am I doing?" "Well, you're stuck in this house raising these kids. What are you... Does your husband think you're an idiot? You need to get out there and prove yourself. You know, you're a smart girl. You need to do this." "Oh, I do?" "Yeah, everybody's doing it, right?" Okay. What's my line proves, that was happening naturally. There was a phase where a woman had their children, raised them, got them into school, and then went and got a job. These women on What's My Line are missuses most of the time, right? They are mothers, they are wives, they have tons of kids. But they're still rocket designers for Lockheed Martin, right? Now, I'm the first guy that loves to see women break into industries they've never been into before, especially. I like them going into the other industries as well. So again, I just think it happened naturally. But it wasn't one of these things. It was a huge emphasis. Now, I've had two personal experiences. I think I've shared them in previous episodes, but they fit perfectly in this episode, which is the following. There was a time I've had plenty of conversations with people I work with who are over 35, females, right? And I was very lucky when I moved to California. The company that I joined had a female CEO. Our company was at least 40% females in major roles, CFO roles, presidential roles, head of marketing roles, right? They weren't taking out the trash, okay? But sometimes I'd have a conversation with these women, and one woman had lost the ability to have children. And she just figured this out. And they said that something had happened in her 30s that her body changed and she was unable to have children. And I never saw a woman sob from her soul more than that moment, probably in my life. If I had, it would only be equal to. But she looked at me and she said, I blew it. And I was so young, I didn't really understand this. I didn't know anything about what I'm saying right now to you. They said and put it together. And she said, I bought this idea that I had to go work and prove myself. And she said, in the end, it hasn't been worth it. No company cares if I really exist or not. Any of the accomplishments I've actually been able to accomplish for corporate America matter nothing to me being a mother, me having grandchildren. The true dream that I was fighting for in becoming a professional has just been erased by becoming a professional. Now, this is probably, I hope, a rare thing that happens, but I've heard it again on a radio interview once, same sort of situation. But something happened when I turned 40 and dated, you know, since I was probably, let's just say 45, I've dated plenty of women who were looking to get out of the rat race of being employed. And they wouldn't say, one of them actually was clever enough to put it into absolutely on point words. She said, you know, I think I've been had. And she had children, right? One of them didn't, and two of them did. But she said, you know, I want to stop working. This is a rat race. This isn't fun. And even if I have a job I like, you know, the freedom of really living just has never occurred because I've always had to work and work and work. My kids have had to, you know, have too much daycare and I didn't get to raise them. And now I have these disconnection points with my kids because they don't know me. Some of them were fortunate enough to raise their kids up to a certain point. But divorce would ensue and the women were out on their own. And that was a big part of the movement of how divorce courts were reengineered by the Rockefellers in the late 70s, early 80s. They were like, hey, if we're going to convince everyone to get divorced the second that something goes wrong, then let's destroy both sides of the family. Right? Let's make the father broke as a joke. And then let's get the other side of the family hooked on consumerism and the entitlement of all this money. Now, obviously, women need money to help raise kids. But the amount of women in my world, including my own mom, that didn't really get the financial support that they needed, we survived. We're all right. We didn't take big, giant bank loans to pay our bills. We just live with a little bit less, right? It takes a really long time for society to ever reach any level of balance, right? And there's all kinds of categories of balance. You know, you look at America. By 1960, we had balanced the educational system to crank out just infinite supplies of awesomeness in every category. Education's obviously as proven by What's My Line for females and males. Tremendous levels of self-employment. It was being self-employed in the 60s was your choice. I would rather work for myself than for a corporation because then it matters. Me working for myself and not spending time every minute with my kid, well, now it kind of matters. And by the way, I can bring my children into my own company. I can pay them their chore money or their allowance through work for our company. I think we had balance in the family as well. I think we had fairly a good balance for folks that were homosexual and didn't want to have any families at all. Or maybe they did and they just wanted to stay what they were. There was a balance there. the way society treated people. Wasn't the end of the world all the time, like it is today. Because people are swooping in today, like the serpent, the story of the serpent, and saying, don't you want this? I think you need more representation here. I think you're being treated poorly here. And they emphasize things that don't really have the intent that they have. Now, always, there's the jerk. There's that community that doesn't accept, you know, forget homosexuality. They don't accept race blending. They don't accept women doing certain things or men doing certain things or whatever. So there's always going to be plenty of things you can cite. But I think in the overall mean algorithm of at least America, I can't speak for other countries, we've had beautiful balances at times. And I think we've lost it. And I think that there has been a sort of renaissance from both sexes of both orientations to regain the balance that we used to have. One of the episodes I did was called The Death of Chivalry. And it's about my journey through chivalry by growing up in the Midwest. Well, chivalry is a demanded attribute of a man as well as a woman, and sort of the degradation of where we are today. And I never received more compliments and private messages from females than from that episode, where people said, even women in my personal circles who were listening to the show at the time, they made an effort to get in my face and tell me, I loved that episode because you're right. When I was young, we used to have it, and now we don't have it. And, you know, some people were like, you know what? Some of the dudes came back to me and said, you know what? You're right. I was raised with it. For whatever reason, I overlooked it, but I'm getting back into it. Some of the dudes said, you know what? I've never let go of it. And I love the response from a woman when I hold the door and she acknowledges me, and I don't even know her, and I'll never, ever see her again in my life. I'm in Los Angeles, California. Our paths will never cross. There's no ulterior motive to get anything out of it. I think that's pretty cool, don't you? Go watch What's My Line. It's on YouTube. There's a channel called What's My Line. Subscribe to it. I will tell you that there are other game shows. Unfortunately, they're cross-pollinating into the channel. And so we have other shows like What's My Secret is one of the shows, I think, that Fred Allen hosted. Fred Allen has other show as well, which is a really weird show, giving away cartons of cigarettes. Some of the episodes actually have the old 50s ads, and I'll tell you, those are jewels. Those are usually early 50 ads. And then the reason why the show got pulled back into digital form is because the Game Show Network, which was a little experiment they did in the late 90s, early 2000s, was trying to use these old shows and then create online games you could play. And, you know, they tried to cross-pollinate. It was a complete failure, but at least they got these shows re-edited. But they'll have like weird commercial breaks that have a couple frames of some modern thing, and then it slips back into the show. Just overlook it. Very few get really super sloppy. But ladies, have a look. Have a look at the truth. That you were celebrated, that you didn't have any problems finding amazing freaking jobs and being amazing human beings back in those days. It's all a lie. It's all a complete lie. And I think most of you know it is if you have any relatives that you're familiar with their past. And again, let's just say it together. Raising a family is the most incredible, amazing job. It's the hardest job that any human being, male or female, could ever accomplish. For hundreds, if not thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years, the female has been the expert at the most complex, amazing job on planet Earth. Not to mention carrying the child for 9 months, right? Ask anyone who's a week from giving birth how much they want to carry that child anymore, right? They're like, let's get this thing out of me, right? Us amazing males, unless we've had a gallbladder attack for 5 hours for 9 months straight, we have no idea what childbirth is like, right? We don't. So my hope is that you'll take this episode as one of celebrating the utter, complete power of being a female. Without any victimization, without any, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, you're dumb, or the other one, which is, it's amazing you have a job given that you're a female, right? Let's flush all that down the drain. We need to rebuild society from the ground up. And this is one of the things we got to fix, right? You guys get to have it all, right? Women, you get to carry a child, get to raise a child, and you get to have the job of your dreams. You really do. Dudes, we don't get at least one of those, right? I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek, but hopefully you can get the overall point of what I'm trying to say. Anyway, I know you feel me. If you haven't been to deepthoughtsradio.com, please go. It's where all the audio, video, lock Facebook group, Patreon pages. I've added a store for now. We'll see if that stays. So if you go there and it's not there, it's because it's probably a real old episode. But the world has changed. But anyway, take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over now.